You know, there's probably not a kid out there who hasn't had to memorize the planets in our solar system, or who hasn't fashioned a grammar school solar system in a shoebox, remember, with a twisted bunch of wire hangers, maybe hanging as a mobile in your classroom, remember that? Or how about your first trip to the planetarium, leaning way back in that darkened auditorium to watch the stars come out and see the whole night sky, more than you could ever view from your rooftop or your backyard because it never got dark enough to see everything or the trees or stuff were in the way. Remember that? I remember that from the Hayden Planetarium in my early days here in New York. And my first guest today has the same experiences. And when she did, she was hooked. She entered into a lifelong love affair with our solar system, the fruits of which come to bear in her most recent book, The Planets. So we're going to start the hour today with a guided tour of the solar system. Your planetary may have left out. You may not hear some of the stuff we're going to talk about today, from, let's say, the history of Mars, as told by a famous Martian rock, to the story of Jupiter presented through the lens of astrology, and, of course, the saga of Pluto. Yes, recently bumped from the planetary lineup by the vote of astronomers. Who was there? She was there when that happened, and we're going to get her account. And, of course, I'm speaking of Dava Sobel. She is a science writer in East Hampton, New York, originally from the Bronx. Right?
That's right.
From the Bronx.
Proud of it.
We New Yorkers, we can make fun of the Bronx.
Right.
She's the author of Longitude and the Planets, out there in hardcover last year and now out in paperback. And she joins me today from our NPR studios. Welcome back, Dava.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the planets. What made you write the book, The Planets? Was it that? Were you influenced going to the Hayden Planetarium as I was?
Oh, absolutely. That's when it started for me. And also in school, because we had really good science instruction in grade school when I was a child. And I got very interested. And my mother was also an astronomy enthusiast and actually knew all the constellations.
Mm-hmm.
So I had all that nice preparation.
You remember that first experience going when you went into the planetarium and you leaned back?
Definitely. And we went every year in school. So it's an indelible memory now. I'm not sure I remember which was the first time, but it was always exciting.
Yeah. You begin a book about the planets with the sun by quoting from the creation story in Genesis and then telling the scientific story of creation, the Big Bang. Do you think in this age of where we're trying to reconcile religion and science that the two can be reconciled this way?
Well, the planets certainly owe everything to the sun. They were all formed at the same time. And that is the creation story that most of us have been told. Scientifically, I don't think they can really be reconciled. But in this book, all links to popular culture were fair game. And I wanted to talk about the planets in ways that would be familiar to people who were not necessarily informed or even interested in astronomy. Much to my surprise, I actually won an award from a religious magazine for that chapter, which was a dubious distinction for me, actually. I took a lot of risks like that in this book.
And why?
Again, to underscore the fact that the planets have played a role in popular culture from before the written word.
Mm-hmm.
They were the most obvious thing in the night sky after the moon, or even after the sun. In fact, the sun and the moon were considered planets by some of the earliest people because they moved. Planet just means wanderer. So anything that was moving with regard to the fixed stars was a planet.
And so much of early science revolved, so to speak, around those planets.
Around figuring out what that was about, why they moved the way they did, why they looked the way they did. It was a great puzzle.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255. Now, let's talk about Pluto for a little bit, because I know you're an expert on it, and you have some inside information about the casting off of Pluto from the realm of planethood. What's your view on this?
Well, frankly, the whole issue about Pluto was about coming up with a definition for this word planet, mm-hmm. because it's never had a scientific definition. And so, contrary to what you've heard or said yourself, the whole meeting in Prague was not really about whether Pluto should be kicked out mm-hmm. of the solar system, but really how to define the word and how to decide whether the Hayden Planetarium did the right thing when it dropped Pluto from the list of major planets a few years ago, or whether some of the new bodies that have been discovered can be considered planets. So I was on the committee that drafted the resolution. Mm-hmm. And then that draft was presented to the World Community of Astronomers for voting. Mm-hmm. And as you know, we were shredded in the voting.
Right.
But it was a very interesting experience because our group of seven people represented widely differing opinions. But after 2 days of talking, we had reached unanimous consensus.
Mm-hmm. It was, go ahead.
And we would have, our definition would have left Pluto in, also would have included a few other small bodies. So we would have had a solar system of 12 objects.
But that was rejected.
Yes. And I really think that both takes are fair. Any definition is arbitrary. You have to come down hard on something, somewhere, and some people are going to be upset. I've been stunned by how upset people are. They just they feel that Pluto's actually been physically ejected from the solar system.
And it is surprising the amount of emotion.
Amazing. And I ask people, why are you upset? And for many people, it's just a question of change. They feel so much has changed, so much has been taken away from them. Why does this treasured memory of childhood have to be affected? Mm-hmm. Others feel it was some kind of cruel plot or just a whimsical behavior on the part of planetary scientists. But it really is this difficult attempt to frame a good definition.
And it doesn't affect the scientists very much, does it?
Well, at the moment it does because they're not in agreement.
Yeah.
Some of them feel that the new definition is still unsatisfactory.
That definition is the new definition?
Well, basically it's a body in orbit around a star that is big enough for its own gravity to have shaped it round, and it has to be the dominant body in its orbit.
Mm-hmm. Has to carve out an orbit for itself?
Right, without other things having as much importance in that orbit. Pluto, for example, has its big moon, Charon, and many other things in its orbit so that it's not dominant the way Neptune or Saturn is.
And so scientists are affected or are still talking, troubled a bit.
Yes. And this new term has been given to Pluto, dwarf planet. But a dwarf planet is not a planet. And in astronomy, there are dwarf stars, which are stars, and dwarf galaxies, which are galaxies. So it's a term that no one can love, dwarf planet.
So it's a committee.
So something,
it's a perfect thing to be done by
voted,
a committee.
but now there will be more committees, you'll see. It's not over.
We haven't heard the last word on it.
No, absolutely not.
Who's the biggest proponent of bringing it back as a planet?
Is there a group of scientists? Yes, there are hundreds of scientists who have expressed displeasure with the voted-upon definition.
Mm-hmm. If it remains as a dwarf planet, does that diminish its role in the solar system? I mean,
well, not to a scientist who's interested in Pluto, certainly not. I think there was some real concern that if the status had been changed before the launch of the New Horizons spacecraft last January, people were afraid the mission might have even been canceled. But it's on its way now. There's no calling it back, which is a good thing. And in 2015, we'll finally find out what Pluto really looks like.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255. Talking with David Sobel, who is author of the recent released paperback, The Planets. And just the cover itself is worth buying the book. It's just gorgeous, the graphics. Do you help choose that at all? That the publisher does this?
No, the brilliant jacket designer, Evan Gaffney, did that.
What, do you have a favorite planet?
Yes, the Earth. I think it's only fair. It's the only planet that would have me. And it's really the best place to live.
Right.
But if I'm looking at the night sky, then I would say Venus would be my favorite. And if there's a telescope around, then it would be Saturn or mm-hmm. Jupiter.
Mm-hmm. I think Venus just pops out there first. It's like the beacon
yes.
in the west.
Yes, when it's there.
When it's there.
Yes.
Do you actually look at the planets through your own telescope?
I do.
Yeah?
I do. I'm very bad with equipment, though. I really... There's so much you can see with the naked eye.
Right.
And astronomers, especially amateur astronomers, are so generous. If anybody wants to see the planets through a telescope, there's always an amateur group ready to have a public viewing night. And they would just love to show you something through their telescopes.
You know, my fondest remembrance of a trip to Las Vegas, of all places, was out there by the Red Rocks. There was a amateur viewing night. And how long can you stay in Vegas and you take a drive outside? And as my way back in, as the sun was setting, I just drove right into the parking lot and had the time of my life looking at, a dozen telescopes.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
And
it's actually more fun for them when newcomers arrive and feel their excitement. They really love that.
Yeah, of course, a lot of people have to get outside because you can't see a lot of, the horizon if you don't get up high enough to see things that are close to the horizon.
Right.
So
Right. I thought you were talking about Vegas.
People
well, have to get out.
Well, yeah. Well, there's so much light pollution now.
Yes.
Yes. That if you're not facing you don't watch the west where they're rising, you don't face the right direction, you're not going to see the planets. Right. They're going to be really drowned out. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with David Sobel, who's author of The Planets. She's going to talk about why she's used some of her artistic knowledge, like talking about astrology when we're talking about the chapter on Jupiter. So it's interesting stuff. She took chances, as she said, in writing the book. We'll have her take a chance with you and your phone calls when we get back. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with David Sobel, a science writer and author of Longitude in 1995, and now The Planets, out in hardcover. And last year, that was released in hardcover. This year, out in softcover, paperback. Beautiful book. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Your chapter about Jupiter is titled Astrology. Why is that?
Astrology is certainly one of the ways people know the planets. And if you ask a group of people, how many of you know your sign? Almost every hand goes up.
Right.
So I didn't think I could leave that out. And astrology has certainly played an important part in the history of astronomy because most of the famous astronomers had to cast horoscopes as part of their work for their patrons. Galileo, Kepler, they all did that work. And so there's a shared history, and I made the astrology chapter about Jupiter because in astrology, Jupiter is the greatest positive force. Mm-hmm. And I worried about this a lot. Carl Sagan was really a mentor to me, and he worked so hard in his life to point out the fallacies of pseudoscience and mm-hmm. astrology in particular. And of course, as a science writer, I'm supposed to say that it's just nonsense. And if you want to know your real connection to the universe, you should study astronomy and realize you're made of stardust, which is true. But still, the astrology is interesting historically. And I felt it legitimately belonged in the book. And my answer to Carl would have been, it's for the purposes of public education.
Well, as another wonderful writer, double Pulitzer Prize writer, John Wilford of the New York Times once said to me, you got to have a little whimsy.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a great fan of his.
Sure. So you know, there's an interesting way you have to present and look at all these things. It's you actually drew a chart for the Galileo spacecraft.
Yes.
Right?
Well, I didn't do it, but I went to an astrologer to have it done. Galileo had done his own chart in his lifetime, so I had that analyzed, and then I had a chart done for the spacecraft. And it was just fun looking at the problems that spacecraft had and comparing that to what was actually in its chart. Mm. If you remember, it had all sorts of problems with its antenna because...
Right. As soon as it was launched, the
antenna wouldn't open,
right.
And then the tape recorder was jamming. So it had all these communications problems. So you look on the chart, and there the planet Jupiter has a square or the worst possible aspect with the planet Mercury, the planet of communication. Now, that's very entertaining.
Very whimsical.
Yes. Yeah. So, but I was roundly attacked for talking about it at all and for saying that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were people who thought I was as earnest about astrology as I'd been about the Bible.
Wow.
So
you took heat for that.
I did.
Yeah.
I still do.
Yeah.
But I would do it again.
Yeah.
And I actually really like that chapter. I think it works particularly well.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get some calls in. Let's go to Robert in San Antonio. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how you doing this afternoon?
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, I had the privilege of listening to Longitude and the Planets, the audiobook version, and I think that, due to the steeped in poetry, the way the planets was, it came through beautifully in the audiobook format, and I just wanted to make that comment.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad you liked it. I listened to it also. I thought she did a very good job of reading it.
Absolutely.
Thanks for calling. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Cindy. And is it Eau Claire? Oh, yeah, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I find it curious also that the entire zodiac is beautifully entiled in the floor of the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and also in the University of Wisconsin-Madison library entrance. It's on a whole wall, and it just seems curious to me.
So, curious that it's there at all?
Just curious because there's so much negativity about the mystical or about the zodiac, the astrological aspect of things. I understand in Greek times the word for astrology and astronomy was one word. They weren't separate.
Do you have a question, Cindy?
Yes, I do. I called to ask about if the author has any comments about the planetoid or dwarf planet Chiron orbiting in a 50-year orbit between Saturn and Uranus. And also, if the second question is if you have any information or confirmation about a 12th planet, what Zacharias Sitchin, the Sumerian scholar, calls a 12th planet with a very highly elliptical 3,000-year orbit. And I'll just hang up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Chiron.
Sounds very knowledgeable.
Yes. Chiron is not included in my book because it's not quite a planet. It's even less of a planet than Pluto may be now. But it does figure in astrologers' charts. They definitely count it in. And that 12th planet, no. What was really interesting was the 10th planet, which was for a long time called Xena, and which really forced the issue of the planet definition, because that body is larger than Pluto. So if Pluto was a planet, then Xena would have been too. But it is not, and it has mm-hmm. now gotten its official name of Eris, mm-hmm. which convinces me that scientists still have a sense of humor.
They do. Yeah, they do. Well, anybody can come up with Charmed and all those kinds of names for things. They do have a good sense of humor. I think the planet that has been in most view lately has, of course, I think, been Mars, considering the rovers that are going around there and sending back these great pictures.
Fantastic images. And the rovers just going on and on and on, far beyond their expected life expectancy.
Yeah, entering their third year, the 3 years now of their 90, the three-month tour.
Days, right. This is why robots are so great.
Are they
space.
Better than people, do you think?
I think they are.
Than for exploring
I really
space?
Do. I mean, there's no question that they last longer, are cheaper to send, go to places that people mm-hmm. will never be able to go. One of the things I worry about with this Moon-Mars initiative is when people are finished with the Moon and Mars, they're really finished.
Right.
And whereas a robot can go to Pluto,
right,
Neptune, they're much more versatile. And yet people seem to need an astronaut in space from time to time just to feel a human response to the the void, the greatness.
You know, I think that's true to a certain extent, but how many people know that they're astronauts right at this moment, orbiting around us, or care, even though, you know that?
It's true. It's not, it doesn't get the attention that it got.
You're
in
showing
the
early days. 60s influence. You see, it was exciting as the World Series,
so
right?
Exciting.
In classrooms,
right.
You turned on the radio, or
right.
The PA system came on when
right.
There was some
everybody
sort of,
followed them.
Everybody followed them, and now no one even knows that they're there. What about the moons of Jupiter? They, well, you know, after was Arthur C. Clarke prescient when he talked about 2001: A Space Odyssey and said, "Go to Jupiter; those moons have something special."
Right,
there.
And even mentioned Europa.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Which is absolutely amazing. And now NASA thinks that maybe there might be something living or coming to life on Europa, which is why the Galileo spacecraft was intentionally destroyed.
Yeah.
In case someday it should go derelict and blunder into Europa and perhaps kill something there.
Let me see if I have one more call I can take. Let's go to Lucinda in Boise, Idaho. Hi, Lucinda.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Hi. I really had I'm fascinated by her discussion and the fact that there's so much great nature of whimsical ideas in astronomy and astrology. I have a question. I have a 3-year-old granddaughter, and I would love to get her interested in the stars and the fact that there's a whole lot more than our neighborhood. Any suggestions for, other than, you know, going to planetariums? Any suggestions for good books?
Oh, I know a nice book called There Once Was a Sky Full of Stars, but that won't teach you the constellations.
Okay.
I'm afraid I don't know anything for children that young, but that's a very good question, and I will have to research that myself.
Yeah, I've been looking, and I've been having a kind of a hard time finding something that will really motivate really young kids to get excited about being, you know, just sitting out in the backyard and looking. And luckily for us, where I live, we can see the stars still.
How nice.
This week. It may, maybe not, someday it'll be like the Bronx, I'm sure, you know. but so far, we can still see the stars.
Well, the Bronx has the Yankees, so everybody else has the stars. Different kind of stars.
Well, there is that. There is. I have a baseball team. Okay.
Well,
thank you.
Sorry to hear that. Thanks, Lucinda. Mm-hmm. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye. You too.
1-800-989-8255. One more call from Bill in New Albany, Indiana.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say what a pleasure it is to speak with you, Ms. Sobel. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if you would comment about, and I apologize, it's been almost a year since I read the book, and I haven't read it since then, although I have read Longitude 3 or 4 times. But the one chapter that has the woman writing the letters,
yes,
about the discovery of either Neptune or Pluto,
it's,
I was very interested in the way you brought the woman's influence in the scientific discoveries in that. I'm currently reading Galileo's Daughter, and I really enjoy the way you incorporate women's influence and contributions into your works.
Thank you. It was about the discovery of Uranus and Neptune. And I did that as a letter from Caroline Herschel, who was the sister of William Herschel, who discovered Uranus. And then Caroline lived a very long life. She lived to be 98. So she was still alive when Neptune was discovered about 60 years later. And I had her write a letter to the only other woman in the world who had also discovered a comet, and that was Mariah Mitchell, young American astronomer. And there's no evidence that they ever had any sort of correspondence, but that seemed the best way to handle that chapter.
Thank you, Bill, for calling.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, we're going to have to say goodbye, David. It's
always
a pleasure to have you. Can come back anytime you'd like, talk about the planets.
I'll take you up on that.
We'll, you know, when another little one is thrown out of we're going to give you a call.
Or if Pluto comes back.
You're right.
I'll
give
here.
Us a call. Okay?
I will
you
call
give
you.
Us a call. You'll be right on to talk about Pluto coming back. David Sobel, author of The Planets. You know her from Longitude, Galileo's Daughter. Out, a terrific book. It was a great the first time, even better the second time for another read. The Planets, welcome. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.